Back together again, you and I wrapping up a busy week on Friday, January 12th, 2024 on Connecticut Today. We started the show with a discussion and a lot of calls regarding the possibility of any state money being used to partially fund a new pro soccer stadium in Bridgeport. We also were joined by Dustin Dunbar, author of You're Doing Great and Other Lies Alcohol Told Me, and also stopping by Quinnipiac University Associate Professor of Law Sheila Hare, discussing the observance of National Human Trafficking Awareness Day. All right, so the invariable question, or one of the invariable questions, is already being asked. And if I remember correctly, because the further away I get from shows, the more foggy my memory gets. When did we talk about that? That was yesterday. No, it was the day before, you moron. Hi, by the way, how are you? Talk about this new soccer stadium in Bridgeport. We have a Connecticut businessman, gentleman apparently does very well, some sort of entrepreneur, who went to UConn, and he is now floating a professional soccer team in a soccer stadium for part of Bridgeport. And the artist's rendering, if you've seen this, if you've gone to the website or go to the Hearst Connecticut Media, Connecticut Post, story today written by Alex Putterman, Brian Lockhart, and Ken Dixon. I got to tell you, the artist's rendering, the computer rendering of this stadium is pretty darn nice. Right on the waterfront, overlooking the turnpike there in I-95. You can see a night render. Stadiums always look better at night, don't they? Stadiums and ballparks with the lights on, showing how it's the, or it could become the beacon of an area, is always cool. And there's a rather airborne rendering, a rather nice rendering of the proposed soccer stadium along the Pequannock River in Bridgeport. And you see it there, you say, wow, that's pretty nice. You've got stands on four sides there around the stands, the seating surrounding the pitch, yes. And you've got seating on all four sides. The side seating looks to be covered. The seating behind the goals looks to be open air on one end and partially covered on another end. You see where the scoreboard would be situated. You see a building behind there that would undoubtedly, I guess, be the administrative offices, the front office, if you will, for the team. And it looks really good. Question is, who pays for it? And we're not seeing any solid numbers yet. And a couple of people, and I talked about this yesterday in our weekly check-in with Lenny Grimaldi from OnlyInBridgeport.com, a website you should check multiple times a day, if not multiple times a week. Who's going to pay for this? Now, I know the immediate knee-jerk, if I can say, because I think that's what happens sometimes. I know the immediate knee-jerk reaction is always, oh, no, you can't have state money in this. I don't want my tax money in it. Well, okay, I guess. And sometimes, there are certain sports franchises in certain cities and certain entertainment venues all around the U.S. and here in Connecticut where you do have ownership or private ownership groups or individuals who are deep-pocketed enough to where they can say, hey, we don't need your help. We think we're going to be good, but we're not going to ask state and local taxpayers to pay for this. And God bless those people. It does happen. It does happen. But the notion that, and I don't know where the numbers are on this place, but the notion that there should not be or people are wary about a state or local investment in this thing, albeit we don't know the numbers yet. But the notion that this should just be, I don't know, shoved aside without any thinking here, I don't think is proper. And this is why I say this. How much money do taxpayers of the greater Bridgeport area send to the state of Connecticut? Whether you live in Bridgeport proper, whether you're in the surrounding suburbs, whether if and or whether you're in the defined market of where this professional soccer team is going to be located and drawing fans from. So it's kind of weird that you get some people who would say, and you always hear this, and I think they're right, hey, my money goes to the state. What am I getting back for it? And, of course, you're getting state services. You're getting infrastructure. You're getting road work on Route 8 and Route 25 and the Parkway and I-95. I understand all that.
Well, darn it, I should get that
because I'm a taxpayer. God bless you. You're right. You're a taxpayer. You should be getting that. But why wouldn't you then want maybe not footing the bill completely, but maybe a percentage, be it whatever percentage it might be? I have no idea what is being floated. But why wouldn't you want the state or even the municipality to help out? Not saying you got to pay for it altogether. I'm not in any way saying the state has to get into the stadium business or the arena business or the city. But I'm just saying, isn't it incumbent? And maybe if incumbent's a little bit of a strong word, does it not make sense from a return on investment point of view to have cities, towns, and even the state of Connecticut invest a little bit, or as they say, pick up part of the nut of what this place is going to cost? Now, apparently, when Governor Lamont was asked yesterday about the prospect of public funding for the stadium, he sounded skeptical. Now, I understand this is the Lower Fairfield County, Gold Coast investor type Ned Lamont. I understand that. He apparently, through his first full term plus, coming up on 2 years here, he looks like he's a pretty good steward of the public trough here, if you will. Far better, way better than past Democrats in this state, including, as much as I love the guy, Bill O'Neill, spent money like it was being printed. Don't get me started on Dan Malloy. So the governor, he told Hearst Connecticut Media here, the reporting here, quote, "I'm pretty cautious about that. But look, if the private investors really think this is an amazing thing and they've got the rights of professional soccer, they want to do that in Bridgeport, that's wonderful. Then go for it." Now, it points out here, the governor's a Democrat, as are all the members of the Bridgeport legislative delegation and the mayor, Joe Ganim. Czech entrepreneur Andre Swanton said he's been awarded. He has the team. He has the team. It would be called the Connecticut United Football Club, but he wants to build a facility along the Pequannock River. And he said this is going to be mostly private funded. Now, that's what he says. We haven't seen any, or privately funded. We haven't seen any numbers yet. But he also said the project, quote unquote, here in the paper, quote unquote, absolutely needs state support as well. And he noted that the state, and I was thinking about this, I'm glad he pointed this out. He noted that stadium renovations for the Hartford Athletic Some of them were picked up by the state. So my question to you is a simple one. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And by the way, I put this up as a question on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WICC600. Pretty simple. What do you think about using at least some state money, which, yes, would be taxpayer money, I get it, to help build this new soccer stadium in Bridgeport to be located along the Pequannock River? Now, but I want you to think about this. Why should the state be into building soccer stadiums? Well, would not some revenue generated, in fact, by that stadium go to the state? You see what I'm talking about here? In other words, the state is going to have its hand out no matter where. So if there will be some manner of state revenues collected from the soccer games and other activities here that may be happening with the new stadium here in a year or two in Bridgeport, shouldn't the state have to kick into this? Maybe it has to in the long run. Now, one person said, no, the team owners should pay for it. And the team owner is saying, at least up front, he's going to pay for most of this, but he wants state help. Why is there such, and I understand you don't want the state to get into the sports business. I get that. But again, if it's going to help generate revenue, and obviously there need to be projections on this. I understand it. I get it. Some people criticize sports teams and ownerships who they say wildly overproject the revenue just to get the funding. I'm sure that's happened. I'm sure it happens all over the place. You know, some of these huge stadiums costing billions of dollars. I get it. We're not talking about that. We're talking about probably an 8,000 to 10,000 seat soccer stadium, which could also be used, I guess, I'm not sure, but maybe for state championship matches, for college soccer, I don't know. But are you automatically against any state money going for this stadium in Bridgeport? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. See, I got to see the numbers. But I'm never going to say, nope, no state money, no sir. No. Look. Here's my contention. I don't know what Mr. Swanson wants as far as state money. We'll see the figure. It wouldn't surprise me if the state ends up wasting more money on a yearly basis than what the owner of this newly awarded team wants as far as assistance here. What do you think? State money for the soccer stadium in Bridgeport? Part of it, not all of it. Part of it or not? All right, back at it. Hour number three of our daily four-hour get-together at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. We'll get back to open phones a little bit later in the show. We'll talk about human trafficking a little bit later on with the show, as I had mentioned. A lot going on today, though it is a Friday, and for many people, the notion of happy hour is already underway, and likely, you know, as the song always says, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. And there are people imbibing alcohol. The vast majority of such can do it responsibly. But there are some people who cannot. And you and I have known numerous people in our lives, our personal lives, our dating lives, our professional lives, our workplaces, that people, through maybe no fault of their own, have trouble with alcohol. And I've had people in my family who have studied this, who've worked in the mental health and addiction areas. And it's something to be reminded of with all the new things out there. Mushrooms now, psychedelic mushrooms may be legalized here in the state. You've got marijuana, gummies, and all this stuff. But alcohol is still a problem for a lot of people. Our next guest wants to talk about that. He grew up poor in the Midwest, an abusive alcohol-addicted father and a grandfather. He wanted not to be like them. He devoured psychology books, researched addiction in his 20s, even earned a doctorate in psychology. He thought he had it beat, but eventually, after drinking socially, which a lot of people think they can do, he too became addicted to alcohol. He wants to talk about that and a program he is involved with. Name of the book, You're Doing Great and Other Lies Alcohol Told Me. Dustin Dunbar is the guest. Hey, Dustin, it's Paul here in Connecticut. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Great. Thanks for having me on.
And Dustin, I got to tell you, I know this is a deadly serious subject. I get that. I've known people in my life that have struggled with this. But I got to tell you, that title, You're Doing Great and Other Lies Alcohol Told Me. I mean, I shook my head and laughed at the same time, right? Because alcohol, just everything is wonderful, right, Dustin? When we have the cover of a few drinks too many, and it really does disconnect us, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, it's just all the new science and everything that is coming out about alcohol is that we got to scream from the mountaintops that it's addictive to everybody. And it's just, it's a 100% addictive substance. Ethanol is what it is. And we got to get away from the idea that it is the elixir of life and it is not a healthy way to kill our pain or drown our insecurities. And so, yeah, that's what it's about. And I have fun with it. Like you said, in the book, it's we can have fun while we heal, and just sharing stories and being vulnerable and helping other people is the whole goal.
So were you worried with your upbringing, Dustin, with your father, your grandfather, what you saw, what you experienced, and then trying to, quote-unquote, drink responsibly? Was there always that worry with you that no matter how far you tried to control it, you would succumb to it?
Yeah, you know, in the back of your mind, you're always, every time you take a drink of alcohol, everybody knows it's not good for you. You know, and we all know the stories. Everybody's got a uncle or father or somebody that died, or, you know, like 3 million people died the year of COVID, and 1.8 million, 3 million died from alcohol related issues and 1.8 million from COVID. You know, so we've all got our stories. So we all know, and yeah, for me, it was one of those things where I vowed at age 7, 8, 9, I was not going to ever drink alcohol. But then the peer pressure comes in, and 5 ads a day, you know, that are barraging you saying it's okay to drink moderately, responsibly, and socially. And everybody else is, you know, even AA is promoting that it is, you know, a certain class of people who get addicted and can't, quote, unquote, handle their alcohol. Well, that is completely false now that we know what alcohol is and what it does to the brain. And we've got all kinds of new imaging and science, and it is 100% an addictive substance. And I want to reiterate, it's ethanol that you're putting into your body. So it's the same thing, just with two different names, alcohol and ethanol.
And yet, heading into this big football playoff weekend, Dustin will see all the commercials out there. And as I point out to people, you never see an old person in a beer commercial because they're trying to establish a brand identity, a brand preference there. So everybody who's imbibing this weekend, at least on TV, being watched by millions of people who are also having a beer or two or four or five too many, they're going to be doing it too. So how do you get away from it? It's almost, you know, Dustin, it's almost impossible to do, isn't it?
Yeah, it is impossible. And I'm even on the beach. I live in San Diego, and I'm with my 9 and 10-year-old girls. And we're on the beach yesterday, and I look up, and there's a plane flying by with this huge banner, Coors Light banner, you know, and advertising it. I'm just like, oh, my God, it's a complete barrage. And they're making so much. Big alcohol is doing the exact same thing. They're doing an incredible job brainwashing us to think that, you know, it makes our lives more fun, sexier, and we have, you know, better times and all this stuff, with it and that our lives suck without it. Well, the complete opposite is the fact that the true joy doesn't come from the bottom of a bottle. It comes from within and what we truly are. And that is infinite, timeless beings that are made of joy. And that is where we got to get to. And the only way to get to that is first to remove the ethanol out of our veins that's pumping through there. And most people, you know, for anywhere, you know, I started drinking when I was like 16, 17, and 20, 30 years of it finally got me, you know, just that social moderate drinking. And so it's just, I'm just screaming from the mountaintop saying, hey, you got to be careful. I'm not defective in any way whatsoever. No one, I don't care if you're the biggest rugby, Irish, you know, tattooed up, bald headed player in the world, that person will get addicted to alcohol once enough is consumed.
Dustin Dunbar is the guest, the name of the book, You're Doing Great, and Other Lies Alcohol Told Me. When you were struggling with this, Dustin, did you know, I mean, you had to know intellectually. You sound like a whip-smart, bright guy. You went through what you did as a kid. You saw what was going on, and yet you were trying to drink, and then you finally succumbed to it. Were you mad at yourself for doing this? Was it like, whatever, I knew this was going to happen? How did you handle that internally?
Yeah, no, I like you were saying, I grew up really poor, and so it was all about, I got into sales, and I was flying around with CEOs and, you know, playing golf on the best golf courses and doing tequila shots with them and thinking I'm living the high life, champagne, first class up in the sky, you know, the pop songs and everything. So in my world, it was like, oh, I'm handling it. I'm not my grandpa. I'm not my dad. I'm my own man, and I can handle my alcohol. They could not handle their alcohol. They must have been one of those 10%, you know, defective type people that I hear about, you know, with all kinds of other stuff. So I'm cruising and I've got a beautiful wife, kids, and then once enough gets consumed, sure enough, I started craving it just like any addictive substance. Started craving it and thinking, believing that I needed it to go to parties, you know, needed it to be social and stuff like that. And so it after a while, and everybody's going to be different when they get addicted. It's just a matter of time and how much volume before it happens.
Do you remember, Dustin, was there a specific moment, an occurrence where you were somewhere, maybe waking up feeling horrible? Was there a moment you said, hey, this is it. I tried. I got to do something else here. Or was that gradual?
It was gradual. I just felt like kept feeling worse and worse and worse. I mean, it's just when you got ethanol running through your veins for 20, 30 years, you know, on a consistent basis, nobody should drink ethanol. I mean, you know, we put it in our cars and, you know, I'm from Oklahoma originally, and all my guys have like $80,000 beautiful big trucks. And they pull up to the gas tank and they're like, I'm not putting any ethanol in my motor. You know, and then that night they're drinking 40% ethanol whiskey in their body, you know. So it's one of those things. We just got to raise awareness and be like, look, you guys, this stuff is nasty and it kills. It deadens your consciousness. It hurts your body. It causes 7 different types of cancer and it's 100% addictive. So, yeah, it was gradual and I just felt gross. I felt blah and I didn't have that joy that I was, you know, like Jesus says to enter the kingdom of heaven, we need to be like children. Well, the thing that gets me with that is that children do not drink alcohol. And when I was a child, I had joy just pouring out of me, like up until I was like 15. And then for some reason, the social reasons, the advertising and everybody started saying, no, you got to have this drink to be an adult and, you know, to show your man and your worth and all, you can handle your drinks. And yeah, so I just fell into that whole social thing that we've had going on.
You say that, and I know folks that have very successfully been 12-steppers that have their coins and they feel that AA has been great for them, Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a family member who used to be a therapist in AA. But your thoughts on AA? It says here that you don't think AA is the only option for folks having a problem here.
Yeah, it didn't resonate for me. And becoming alcohol-free is not a competition. So if it resonates for you, then by all means, do it. But what I've created is a different approach where we at the Alcohol-Free Revolution believe and start really going into science of what's going on in the brain with alcohol and showing that it's 100% addictive to everybody. And so the big thing that I do, it's an evolution of AA. AA started in 1935, and they were doing the best they could with what they had with science and medical and all that stuff. So I have nothing but love and admiration for them. So I'm just kind of feel like I'm taking the torch and saying, okay, look, it's not just a certain class of people that can get addicted. This stuff is 100% addictive substance, and we have to start preaching that to our children, that you can't drink it moderately and socially and think that it's okay. It will get you at some point.
And it's interesting, Dustin, because, and I love doctors, I have friends and relatives of mine in the medical profession, but I notice now the conflict that even some medical folks, Dustin, seem to have where, hey, a couple of glasses of wine is good for your heart, or, you know, this amount of drinks is okay. Yet, dovetailing back into what you said, I saw a couple of stories in the past month where there's new research, and this came from doctors too, that said essentially the stories, if I can summarize, said no amount of that, none, zero, it's poison, drink something else, this is not good. And when I heard you say that, it immediately clicked. I remembered that.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's just come out, like you're saying, is just two glasses of wine per week causes a 15% increase in breast cancer for women. And now they're going into, what does two glasses of beer cause for men? Because that's, you know, how we're doing, right? So they're doing more studies with that. But that is the whole point of this, is you have to be so careful. We have to treat it like cigarettes, the same thing. And like, I smoke a cigar like once a month. I know that that causes cancer. Yeah. I know that that's addictive. However, I still do it. Okay, if you have that 100% understanding of that alcohol substance, of what that truly is, just like you do a cigarette, then fine. That is your choice. I'm a free-loving American. I don't want prohibition, anything like that. All I'm saying is be so careful with what you're doing. Teach your kids that this is a nasty, addictive substance that will cause cancer and so many other diseases.
Mm. The website, folks, if you want to learn more about Dustin Dunbar, it's very simple. Dustin-Dunbar, Dustin-Dunbar, DustinDunbar.com. Once again, the name of the book and the title caught my eye right away. You're doing great. And Other Lies Alcohol Told Me. Dustin, a pleasure chatting with you. Good luck, my friend, and we will chat hopefully down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. Dustin Dunbar, you're doing great. And Other Lies Alcohol Told Me. And once again, his website, if you want to get more info here, get more information about his views on recovering from perhaps alcohol abuse, or maybe your worries that you're not being able to handle this, Dustin-Dunbar.com. All right, back to open phones just a little bit from now, last segment here. We'll do that at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You know, with everything going on around the world, whether it's what's in the Middle East or other conflicts, or especially at the southern border, we hear the term, and Lord knows I've talked about it, Melissa has, and in the midday, our buddy Eric Erickson has, also Lisa Wexler, human trafficking. It's not just a world and national issue, it's local as well. And joining us right now is Quinnipiac University Associate Professor of Law Sheila Hare on the observance that was this week. It was actually yesterday, National Human Trafficking Awareness Day. And it's one of those things that people hear and they go, how in the year 2024 is this still a problem? Joining us right now, as I mentioned, Professor of Law at Quinnipiac, Sheila Hare. Professor, how are you? Good to have you back. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. Define, as we start here, define, Professor, human trafficking. I mean, it's in the news all over the place, but for purposes of law enforcement in this discussion, what technically is human trafficking?
Well, I'll tell you what it's not. A lot of people confuse it with smuggling, which is the crossing of borders, which may be voluntary or involuntary. And when I try to define trafficking, I say there's no real quintessential textbook trafficking case. In my experience, there's always unique aspects. But it's essentially making someone against their will work or perform sexual acts. And I can talk a little bit more about it.
Sure.
Against their will
sure.
requires force, fraud, or coercion. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead with the definition. Absolutely. Sure.
Yeah, and when you're talking about force, I think it's easy to find, right? Like, there are lots of examples come to mind, like beatings. There can be rape, sexual assault. With fraud, lies and deception. So some of the things we see is like telling somebody, hey, you can be a model, come down to my place and you'll have a great career. And it turns out that there are sexual acts required and there's a situation where the person doesn't feel comfortable saying no. Domestic work is another example of lies and deception. And this happens a lot in Connecticut, especially since we have a rich population where people can afford to have a domestic workers in the home, helping them take care of kids or take care of the house. The person is told, hey, come work for me. I'll pay you. It'll be good. You'll get decent working hours. Turns out my passport is confiscated. The employer is keeping my money for safekeeping. And then finally, coercion, right, which is sometimes a little harder to define. It's like illegitimate threats. And the examples we see in our clinic are like, you know, essentially saying to someone, I have a compromising picture of you. I'm going to, you know, send it out to the world, your family, your friends, everybody, unless you do what I say. And the one I see a lot with undocumented folks is, you know, you are undocumented. You have no rights. I can get you deported. And especially with my female clients who have children, for example, who may be U.S. citizens, you know, that is something that can be incredibly powerful in getting them to do almost anything.
It sounds, Professor, like maybe in all these situations you just outlined, is money or, you know, just making money off this or the accumulation of cash against somebody's will, is that a common denominator here or not?
That is absolutely a common denominator. And I was going to say, in terms of the sexual acts, we often say commercial sex acts. So 100% this is for gain, and that's why the traffickers essentially do it. Absolutely.
And it's sad because, again, people think, I think, and you've probably run into this, human trafficking. Okay, we see it on the news. We see it on cable news. There are all these network specials. Yet, in my business, and obviously yours, I come across stuff where, here in Connecticut, police in whatever city or town, Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, Fairfield, Shelton, Ansonia, are conducting a human trafficking operation. So it's not just not here. It could be down the street.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's even surprised me as someone who's had a long-term interest in this is the extent to which it's hidden and maybe occurring under our noses. And, you know, one of the things we like to talk about is a lot of people talk about sex trafficking, but I think especially with labor trafficking, it's invidious and it's I think, much more prevalent than we know. It may be at the restaurants that we're frequenting. It may be the food that we get, the farms that we have in our state. It may be construction sites, you know, landscaping, nail salons, massage parlors. And, you know, I think same thing with sex trafficking, although I think what's dangerous is we don't have as good a sense. Like the automatic images don't spring to mind with labor trafficking. But absolutely, with both, it's hidden. And it's certainly happening here in the state. And we have lots of examples. We work closely with DCF, Department of Children and Families, and they keep numbers on the number of children that are subject to trafficking right here in our state. And I think a lot of us would be surprised that it's happening out of schools and in places where we would never suspect.
Okay, and leading into that, and Professor Sheila Hare of Law at Quinnipiac is the guest talking about the observance this week. It was yesterday, National Human Trafficking Awareness Day. Professor, without obviously naming names or getting specific, you said it's happening in the state here and closer than people would think. You have an example or two, just kind of a generic example to illustrate how close this might be?
Well, you know, you say generic, and again, I'm like, there's no generic example. But yeah, I mean, the one that comes to mind that I always find really incredibly shocking is a young girl from a relatively affluent background. Mm-hmm. Her parents noticed, this is Connecticut, her parents noticed that her grades were slipping. You know, the thing that springs to mind is, okay, maybe it's drugs. So they say, you know, we're going to put you in an after-school program, and her attendance goes up. She says, I'll behave. You know, they're thinking everything is good. And what's actually happening is that at the after-school program, she goes to school, and at the after-school program, the children are not being kept tabs. Nobody's keeping tabs. And so the trafficker is picking her up from the school at the end of school and returning her before after-school ends, and she's going home on the bus. And during that period, she is being trafficked. And, you know, the other example, my students and I, law students, were in Guatemala just recently.
Yeah.
You know, we see this, gosh, stories about, you know, a young woman from Guatemala who wants to do better for her family and is told, hey, you can get a job in the city. Lo and behold, she's on a bus to the city, and the guy who's driving the bus says, nope, we're not going to the city. He puts a gun to her head when she wants to get off. Nope, we're going to the United States. She gets here and finds that she is she's being sold for work. And, you know, we see people who are under those conditions for like years, right? And are too afraid to come forward and to speak out.
Professor, I know we talked once before on this, I believe, and you would mention that time, and I'd love for you to do this again on the same subject, that, you know, people can help here. They can see, you know, there are people around the neighborhood, the neighbors and the people that know what's common and what's not. And sometimes the old new phrase, if you see something, say something, right?
That's exactly right. And I, you know, one of the things I didn't mention is I think the statistics are completely unreliable simply because what we have is the tip of the iceberg at this moment. And when our numbers go up in terms of reported cases, I always think it could mean that we're actually just doing our jobs better, because I think there's so much out there that we're not getting at. So absolutely. We were just doing a training with Morgan High School students in Clinton. And one of them said, you know, what if I'm wrong? Right. And I think we said, absolutely. If you see something, say something. Because what we're asking you to do is, if there looks like somebody's in immediate physical harm, of course, call 911. But if you just see something suspicious and you're not sure, you should be calling the National Trafficking Hotline. And if you suspect it's a minor, there's a DCF heart hotline that you should be calling. And what happens is, you know, they're not like jumping in and sending the cops with sirens blaring. They are hoping to get tips from various people so that they can put the pieces of the puzzle together and determine whether they need to intervene, and if so, how, right? So they're not, that's your actions alone are not going to result in somebody being unfairly accused, but you are providing essential information to the authorities so that they can use their expertise and intervene and hopefully, you know, help stop the cycle of trafficking.
And have there, Professor, been times that you have heard of or know of where just kind of an innocent, hey, there's just something weird about that house or people I see coming and going, have those innocent kind of tips turned into something bigger?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's about keeping our eyes and ears open. And I think, you know, sometimes we say, oh, it's the job of the firemen or the police. I remember hearing from one woman who was trafficked in a home. She was there to be the nanny for the children. And she said, actually, there was a fire in the kitchen, and the firemen came, and no one asked, like, why was this 16-year-old taking care of very young children and not in school during the school day, right? But what happened with her is she happened to be in the right place at the right time. One of the neighbors approached her, and that was actually how she ended up being connected to help. So, you know, churches have been helpful, but I usually think it's just someone who cares enough to start, being inquiring. The only caveat I want to say, though, is we don't encourage people to be vigilantes,
sure,
right? So I think the response is clearly, if you see something, you don't want to intervene. You want to call someone who can then figure out the appropriate way to respond, because you can really put the trafficked person in danger. You can put yourself in danger, and you can put others around you if something goes wrong with your attempts to intervene.
And finally, yeah, I can imagine that, you know, you could go in and get your gun and go over to the house and quote unquote rescue the girl, but that's not going to work, because I would imagine, Professor, some of these cases do take a while to make sure that there's enough evidence there to get an arrest and, you know, some kind of an indictment.
Absolutely. And I think, frankly, the person themselves, I've heard from so many folks, even people who are now in the anti-trafficking world, who say it was years after I was being trafficked that I suddenly thought about it and realized, oh, my God, that was my situation. So I think even the person themselves often doesn't recognize it, and 100%. So we're really trying to work with, in terms of the criminal justice system, work with law enforcement. You know, our students are also working on legal reforms, right? And I think one of the things we need to help, you know, allow people to come out and rebuild their lives is working in the criminal justice system to identify those victims, those trafficked persons more, and realize in some cases, or at least allow the court to consider evidence like, hey, I did this bad thing. Like, I might have been shoplifting. Mm-hmm. I might have even assaulted a buyer, you know, who was yep. in the hotel room trying to assault me sexually. To be able to allow the judges and the system to consider that evidence when they're meeting out punishment, and frankly, in deciding whether they should be punishing folks. And I think we're increasingly making police are increasingly aware, prosecutors are increasingly aware. And one of the things I would love to see is expanding the ability for trafficked people to present an affirmative defense and frankly, just evidence to allow the judge or whoever is making the decision as to criminal sentences, give them that information so that they can have a more informed decision about what is the appropriate response.
Quinnipiac University Associate Professor of Law Sheila Hare, this week's observance. It was yesterday, National Human Trafficking Awareness Day. Professor, good to hear from you again. Take care. And don't hesitate to reach out at all if there's something going on that you want to let people know about, okay?
Well, can I, if I may,
sure.
you open the door. Sure. We are having Awareness Week. This week is Awareness Month, but we have scheduled our Awareness Week so as not to conflict with any of those events. So from February 19th to the 23rd, Awareness Week is happening at Quinnipiac, and I just want to spotlight two panels.
Sure.
We have two male-identifying survivors. I've heard one of them speak before, and honestly, it's just changed my entire view of this issue. Mm. So I really encourage you to come. That's Thursday the 22nd in the evening, 6 to 8. And then on Friday the 23rd, this is February, we're having a panel of folks talking about the vulnerabilities of undocumented kids coming over the border, because we've seen a lot about the exploitation of these kids mm-hmm. in the workforce, right? And so this would sort of try to sort of expose people or make them more aware of some of the processing and what it's like for kids as they come to the Connecticut alone sometimes and try to navigate being in the United States. So we'd love to see everybody there. These events are free and open to the public. And, you know, let me know if we can send a flyer your way and you can raise awareness and encourage people to come out.
All right. Good stuff. Professor, thank you. And we'll chat down the road. Thank you.
Thank you again. Appreciate it. Have a great night.
Bye-bye.